Grace and peace be with you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. Good morning. Okay, that was, you might be confused, simply because I was reading something that you didn't have in front of you. Not that you should be reading anything anyway during the gospel proclamation. In fact, Jesus calls you hearers of the word. He does not call you readers of the word. So I always find it odd that I, like you, when I go to church, I'm sitting here reading while someone as lovely as Roberta or Patrick get up and prepare a reading and read it to you to listen for. And here we are reading the thing like this. Now, you know, it's a new battery, you can hear it, but we are hearers of the word. And so some people say, well, they need to read it to understand it. But I think it's best to encounter it and to take it in. Now, you might not get every word, but it's a different act of hearing the word rather than reading it. At Bible study Tuesday morning at the spinning wheel, we read it. We read it three times. It's a different idea of worship together. The hearing versus the reading. Which is why I'm about to say something I hope doesn't shock you. I'm just staring at what's about to go on the internet. But no one listens to it anyway. So, all right, I'll go ahead. I don't care what you believe. I just don't care. Now, I'll get to why I say that shortly. We just heard the third of 4 weeks where we're stuck in the sixth chapter of John's Gospel. 2 weeks before I got last week, and then next week. And God bless Michelle Leslie, because she's going to be a cleanup hitter, number four, because she's preaching on the same idea, Jesus, I am the bread of life, this passage in John's Gospel. There was some controversy in the early, very first Christians had to decide, all right, how many Gospels are there? What is our sacred text? What are we going to use to describe who we are? They had scraps of the letters of Paul. They put them together. They had different sections of the Gospels they were reading to each other and telling and retelling and putting together. The communities of Matthew and John and Luke and Mark were putting these texts, sacred texts together. The very first generation that encountered Jesus of Nazareth, their Bible, the New Testament, is being organized and put together. It's a stunning accomplishment from a historical perspective that our sacred text is organized and unified and put together so soon after the earthly event took place, the crown. And no literature in humankind is that the case. But I'm not here to prove text what how important Scripture was, except to note that the fourth gospel, John's gospel, is so unlike the other three. It's just bizarre. And I'm getting to what you believe shortly. I'm not letting that drift. In the three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're very similar. They're called the Synoptic Gospels for a reason. The same eye you look at, following the general trajectory, and they tell all the beloved stories you like to say and know. So the stories are called parables, aren't they? So watch me embarrass someone. And Natalie, can you name a favorite parable of yours? You can look to Mom for help. What? Good Samaritan. That comes to mind a lot. And it's a reason why we know that one so well. It's a great story. We know the parables. John's Gospel has none of that. There are parables in John's Gospel. Oh, a couple. What John provides us is something thoroughly and utterly different. Completely thick and mysterious. And almost beyond our comprehension in the way in which he writes the story about an encounter with Jesus, the Son of God. It's just different. And thank God for it. It's a wonderful thing. But there was some conversation in the early church about whether it should have been included. And on next Sunday, the fourth Sunday of listening to the Bread of Life passage, you might think the same thing. But instead of parables, the material is about the identity of Jesus as part of who God is. And instead of a bunch of parables, there's this thing called a book of signs that are performed by Jesus that disclose his identity to the church, to us, to the world. You know the first sign? It's usually the butt of many jokes. Did you hear the one about the police officer pulling over the priest for drunk driving? He said, oh no, Jesus did it again. I thought it was worse. The dumb jokes like that. So the very first sign, the wedding at Cana. There are seven signs. The last one is the one by which he begins his spiral down with the conspiracy of the Judeans to arrest and kill him. That's the sign of the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11. In between, there are various signs that take place, one of which is the feeding of the 5,000 that gives rise to this whole chapter 6 and the identity of Jesus as the bread of life. Okay, not boring you yet about John, but things we should know. And Jesus, throughout this section, is describing himself in what would have been very powerful, familiar ways to the early Christian, who would have been Jewish and who would have known the Torah, the first five books. And Jesus is describing himself throughout this section as something that we find perfectly great poetry and meaningful for our hymnody. I am the good shepherd. I am the gate of the sheep. I am the light of the world. I am the living water. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection. I am the bread which gives life to the world. The I am passage would have been immediately known to anyone listening to it as that moment of epiphany of the divine revelation of God's providence to Moses. Right there, the burning bush, Mount Sinai. And Moses going, okay, I got your idea. Now, who, and they won't believe me, who should I say sent me? And we know, anyone old enough to remember the Ten Commandments, tell them I am essentially. I am who I am. So when Jesus is saying, I am, he is identifying himself with the very presence of God. And throughout this thick, mystical section in John's Gospel, we are hearing something majestic, I am, and something rather pedestrian, bread of life. Throughout John's Gospel, the major verb that's used more than any other, we have mistranslated over the centuries and into English into the verb believe. That's not really what the original text is meant to be. It's meant to be faithing, in a way. And I could argue, but since faith is a noun, it doesn't naturally fall into the way. So belief seems to be an appropriate way to use that verb, but that's really so far removed from what Jesus is asking us to do. Believing the right way is the crudest and cruelest thing some of us ever do. And so it's just such a worldly difference between having belief and having faith in the way we look at it. Your intellectual powers, your training in catechism, the way we raise our children in school and elsewhere, we have this notion that somehow intellectual assent to a set of principles is belief. I can't argue into anything, really. My powers of persuasion are limited as are everyone else's. However, if I cook you a really good meal, you'll be grateful for it. You know, all of you are so kind every annual service auction to bid up my Cajun boil and to spend too much money so that I can cook for 50 people a shrimp dinner. It's a fun thing. Has anyone had it? Did you like it? No, yeah, okay. Oh, Pat, you're out. Having an encounter with it, tasting it, and taking it into you. Did anyone ever get sick from any of my Cajun boils?
No.
I'm very proud of that fact, by the way. Having done 60 of them, that's a good record. I am thinking that your experience and encounter of it leaves you with a feeling about what it was and what it meant to you. The conversation around the table with all the food spilled out on top, the flavors, the taste, the hurricanes, maybe. I don't know. So I can't discuss with you about the value of it. I can only invite you to remember and to kindle a thought about what that was and what it meant to you. When Jesus says, "I am the bread of life," he and have faith in this. He is saying, you have to put your life in, I am putting my life into you, you're taking yourself into me. I am feeding on this divine life, and it is part of who I am, and I'm putting my whole life into it. I will die without food. I don't exist without it. So Jesus is saying one thing quite profound and mysterious, and then something quite tactical and practical. Now, speaking of almost dying, not all of you are on Facebook, so my recent post yesterday, I'll recall today. Somewhere around 17,000 feet going up Kilimanjaro, there was a moment where there was nothing I could do but follow the person in front of me. And when you have that little oxygen, and if you're a person who is susceptible to acute mountain sickness, as I learned that I was, and you can't ever know until you're at a place that has an altitude that would challenge you, you're left with one alternative. Just do what the person in front of you is doing. At a certain point, my life totally depended upon the guide in front of me. And to be sure, to get me down off the mountain when I was not able to breathe anymore after having gotten to a certain peak, I came back down. He refused to let me go to sleep because all I wanted to do was put my head, I was just going to sit on the rock for just a minute. Vincent, I'm just going to, now I pulse here, I'm just going to close my eyes and I'm just going to rest for a minute. Just give me 5 minutes, I'll catch my breath and I'll keep going. Vincent knew better. Vincent knew if I closed my eyes, I would die. That with my pulmonary edema, my lack of breathing, taking a rest would be the end of it. The only medicine, the only resolution was to get down to below 15,000, about 15,000. I had another 2,000 feet of descent. So Vincent wouldn't let me close my eyes. Phil, don't close your eyes. He was at one point kicking dust at me, pushing me down, slapping me around, a little bit, not slapping me, but just generally annoying me. So that I could not sleep. He would not let me sit down. He wouldn't let me close my eyes. My whole life depended upon what he was doing to keep me alive. And I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. I didn't need to believe anything about Vincent and his training and how many times he goes up to this thing twice a month. Can you imagine? Twice a month, he's been there 140 times at the top of Kilimanjaro. I just can't imagine that as a lifestyle. But here he is. And so I didn't, at a moment, question. I just didn't have this idea, I didn't see any credentials. I just did what he said to do. And I lived. It was, I had to eat, I had to sleep, I had to breathe, I had to follow Vincent. Having faith in Jesus is much like, doesn't mean we don't think, we don't have a conversation and an argument about the virtues of transubstantiation versus real presence. For any former Catholics who are Roman Catholics who are among us, you know, we can have a real conversation about what does this bread and wine become after the priest waves his hand over the top and we say our prayers and come to the altar. There are volumes and libraries, and people burning at the stake over the conversation of real presence, transubstantiation, a memorial meal, agape feast, all the ways you would look at communion for the Last Supper. Having a mutual assent about a series of languages and words and nouns and so on that get us, supposedly, into the way we all think about a thing in the same way. If when you come up here and you stretch out your hands and you take food that gives you life and you have nowhere to go to get that food, then that's good enough for me. If you know there's no other place you can go that can sustain your life, I think you have a profound understanding of the sacrament of the Eucharist and the encounter with Jesus that shapes, saves your life. I'm not sure Vincent is Jesus to me. Maybe. I don't know. I'll have to think about it. But you might be the only food another human being needs to stay alive. The food of your presence in their life. The food of a kindly word given in the right time. The food of, you know, I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing and I'm going to go and maybe take you to where you need to be. The food that says, you know, I'm going to church, want to come with me? You look like you could use some prayers. The food that says, you know, let me join the vestry and see what they're doing. The food that says, I'll let them join the vestry and put up with it. Today we say our formal goodbye to the Baptists, who have been here 3 to 4, not even 4 years. And yet we're in a room because we have a CO now. Which is the rudest thing. But it shows you how we need the food that each of you brings to us, as the Baptists have brought it to us here. I'm really lousy at saying goodbye because I'm happy that you're only leasing your house or renting it. Because that allows me the fiction in my mind to think, oh, after a couple of years, they'll come back. But I'm enough of a realist of a priest to know the people move, and they move. So I'm going to deal with sadness about it, but I just want to say to the whole church, I'm alive because of the food you have provided. Ask Christ to me. Lauren and John, Liam and Hazel May have been a delicious meal. And so now, correcting for any heresies that may have been preached, let us stand as we affirm our faith by saying together the Nicene Creed.